He was out for a night of dancing with his friends in NYC when a family from Utah was brutally attacked on the subway. The police were quick to arrest him and force a false statement from him, but he says he didn't even know a murder had taken place. This is the true crime story of Johnny Encapié, the New York City dancer with the too tight pants. Hi friends, I'm Katie, and this is Katie Does Crime. Thank you for joining me for the first time if you're new here, and hello to the usual scoundrels and rapscallions. Please consider subscribing or joining me on Patreon if you'd like to hear more true crime stories. Now, I'm lucky to live in New York City in this golden age where crime is low and I can feel completely safe walking alone at night. Some of the media loves to talk about NYC as this, you know, lawless place where murder is out of control. But places like Savannah, Georgia, and Columbus, Ohio actually have way more murders per capita. According to the FBI, NYC ranks 80th on a list of U.S. cities in murders. But in 1990, things were very different. There were almost five times as many murders in 1990 as there were here last year. And 1990 is when the Watkins family visited NYC from their home in Provo, Utah. 22-year-old Brian, a Mormon and former tennis instructor, was in town with his mom, dad, brother, and sister-in-law for the U.S. Open tennis tournament in Queens. They were staying at a Hilton hotel on West 53rd Street, north of Times Square, where many of the famous Broadway theaters are. But they wanted to have a Moroccan dinner in the hip, artistic neighborhood of Greenwich Village, you know, where Monica, Chandler, Joey, and the rest would live a few years later. So they were waiting on the 7th Avenue subway platform at 53rd Street late on the night of September 2nd, 1990. Totally unprovoked, a group of kids attacked them, knocking down Brian's father. They used a box cutter to hack open his pants pocket, creating serious gashes in his legs in the process. They grabbed Brian's mother by her hair and then kicked her in the face and chest. Brian attempted to stop them from hurting his mother, and they stabbed him in the chest. As they tried to escape with $200 stolen from Brian's dad, equivalent to about $450 today, Brian chased them up an escalator despite his wounds. He lost the ability to follow them near the station's token booth, collapsing on the floor. His pulmonary artery had been severed, and he later died in an ambulance. The family later sued the city for the unsafe subways and settled for $300,000. It was another brutal killing in a year where over 2,200 of them would take place. More people only died in NYC in one year during the September 11th World Trade Center attacks. Time wrote a cover story that year called The Rotting of the Big Apple. The New York Post would put out a cover story appeal to Mayor David Dinkins that read, "Dave, do something." The police had to act fast to quiet the concerns of a city that was already on edge. They learned that a group of kids, 40 to 50 of them, had come from Queens to go dancing to a Latin DJ at the Roseland Ballroom on West 52nd Street. Most of them left the subway station once they arrived, but some of the teenagers came back down to the platform to rob someone for the $15 they needed to get into the nightclub. A witness said he saw the big group of kids leave the subway on their way to the ballroom as he was standing outside, but then he saw several of them go back downstairs after one of them jumped the turnstile and opened the exit gate for everyone else to pass through. Minutes later, a wave of people in a panic came rushing up from the platform after seeing the crime take place. And that's when the witness went downstairs and saw the bleeding and hysterical mother of Brian Watkins. Police took this witness to the ballroom, where he pointed out two teenagers he'd seen at the subway that night. The remaining members of the Watkins family were later brought to the ballroom and asked to identify the two. They confirmed that these two kids had taken part in the attack against them. One of the boys confessed that night and gave a statement, and at the same time, the police collected more descriptions from the Watkins family about who had come for them. By the time the Roseland closed the next morning, detectives were waiting outside to make more arrests. Two of the suspects immediately confessed and implicated three more guys. And three of the suspects also implicated 18-year-old Johnny Encapié. Juan Carlos Johnny Encapié of Bayside, Queens, New York, was proud of how his Colombian immigrant parents, Carlos and Maria, had made a life in New York City. He was just a high school senior in 1990 when the stabbing took place. The next evening, when police picked up Johnny from his mother's house, she was crying and he was scared. He said he was just a skinny kid who had never been in that type of situation before. The police later said he had confessed and his statement had been recorded. Done and done. After a year, the DA's office dismissed charges against one of the 8 total suspects who were arrested. This guy refused to confess, and no one else was implicating him, so they just didn't have enough to go on. They tried 3 of the remaining guys together, and the other 4 together, being sure to separate Johnny from one of the guys to keep his lawyer from having a leg up. See, this guy had said during his police interrogation that Johnny wasn't there during the robbery and stabbing, that Johnny just wasn't part of it. And since the DA had ensured that guy wasn't part of Johnny's trial, the guy's statement was ruled as hearsay. It wasn't allowed to be mentioned at Johnny's trial. The mother of Brian Watkins, the young man who was stabbed, couldn't quite pick Johnny out in a lineup. She said he just looked vaguely familiar. There was no physical evidence, no forensic evidence, nothing really tying him to the scene, but there was his taped confession. Only Johnny said that was coerced. He said several detectives had interrogated him, and one of them, down to a t-shirt and smoking a cigarette, beat him, slapped him, grabbed his hair, kicked him to the floor, screamed at him over and over, and blew smoke in his face. He called Johnny a liar, yelled racial slurs at him, and said he wouldn't last long in jail. At that point, Johnny says the man gave him a confession to memorize and repeat for the camera, and Johnny did as he was told to make the abuse stop. He was told he'd be able to go home if he just said what was on the statement.
If he wasn't there, I wanted to know why he confessed.
Why did you do that? What did you think it would get you?
It would get me to go back home. That's what they told me, that by memorizing the story and confessing it to another, as he said, quote unquote, pretty lady in another room, right, that I would go right back home. And I believed him.
Johnny's real story was that he was part of the group of kids going dancing at the Roseland Ballroom, yes, but his pants were too tight for a wallet that night, so he'd given his money to a friend to hold on to. It's a little detail that I just love, these too tight pants and the fact that Johnny is sure to tell you that they were designer. He wouldn't have needed to rob anyone because he helped out in his mom's accessory business and earned $150 per week. When the group arrived at the subway station near the ballroom, Johnny couldn't find his friend with the money and went up and downstairs searching for him. At one point, the big group of panicked people came at him, so he ran back upstairs and happened to spot his friend. And then they just went dancing. Johnny says he didn't know a murder had occurred until he saw the news the next day. In 1991, both groups, 7 young men in total, were all sentenced to 25 years to life in prison. One of them admitted that he was the one who stabbed Brian Watkins that night. Johnny maintained his innocence, and the entire evidence against him was that he looked vaguely familiar to the victim's mom. Johnny's lawyers appealed several times over the course of 15 years, but lost every time. They even got the case reopened once, but the DA's office closed it again, saying, yeah, they were sure Johnny did it. Of course, the prosecutor who led the reinvestigation was the same one who had put Johnny in prison in the first place, so one might say it wasn't exactly unbiased. But a journalist and professor at the City University of New York, or CUNY, was convinced Johnny wasn't the guy. He interviewed Johnny while writing an article on false confessions and then decided to write a whole book about the case. And while writing, he found that there was another guy in the group of 7 convicted who agreed that Johnny wasn't part of the actual crime. This guy, unfortunately, had never been interviewed by Johnny's defense. But he said that he knew Johnny wasn't on the platform at the time because they were actually together. When the journalist asked to speak to the other young men convicted of the crime, 2 more of them said they don't remember Johnny being involved, nor even being there at all. The other 4 just simply didn't respond to his request or said their lawyers had advised them not to. So in 2013, Johnny's lawyers sought a new trial for him. They had a sworn statement from the guy who never confessed to the crime and was eventually let off the hook, and he said that he could see Johnny at the time of the crime, and Johnny was not part of the crime. They also learned that this guy had suffered the same abuse under the detectives that Johnny had. Another of the 7, one of the ones whose attorneys had advised him not to speak to the journalist before, spoke up this time and also agreed that Johnny hadn't been involved. And the lawyers were able to include the statement that had been excluded from Johnny's first trial, where the guy had told the police that neither Johnny nor the guy who could see him while the crime was being committed were involved.
Hughes also watched the original interrogation videos And for the first time, he saw how that other suspect told cops that Hincapier and another teen were not at the crime scene.
They all needed money?
No, Johnny and Kevin left.
Okay.
Hughes was intrigued, especially when he heard the suspect say a second time that Hincapier was not involved.
So there were eight people surrounding the
five? Six.
There were six?
Okay. Yeah, because the two of them left.
At pretrial hearings in 2015, a new witness came forward and said she had seen the attack and Johnny wasn't part of it. She knew him from the neighborhood and knew he wasn't on the platform then, but she'd been scared to get involved and had only told her mother way back when. So a new trial was granted in October 2015 based on the fact that these witness statements likely would have led to a different result for Johnny. The judge vacated Johnny's previous conviction and let him out on bond before his new trial. The prosecution appealed this decision, but the New York City Supreme Court said, nah. And then, incredibly, the charges were completely dismissed on January 24, 2017. I guess they knew they had nothing to go on. Johnny was released after wrongfully serving 25 years in prison and ran right into the open arms of his mother, who supported him throughout his incarceration. He said his first meal would be a seafood dinner, and he would work on trying to understand what the big deal about selfies was, while learning to use a cell phone for the first time. In October 2022, Johnny won $4.8 million for his unjust conviction, and in November 2022, he won another $12.9 million in a civil rights lawsuit for malicious prosecution, fabrication of evidence, and false imprisonment. Today, Johnny's 50 years old, and he and his partner have two beautiful girls. He seems to be an amazing father and uncle. He's still quick to praise his mom and all she's done for him. And he rightfully calls himself a wrongful conviction expert and is an advocate for criminal justice reform and changing police interrogation procedures to end false confessions. As one of the leading researchers in the psychology behind false confessions has said, detectives will oftentimes make up their minds about a certain suspect and then do everything in their power to get that confession. He says, "The purpose of interrogation is therefore not to discern the truth, determine if the suspect committed the crime, or even evaluate his denials. Rather, police are trained to interrogate only those suspects whose culpability they establish on the basis of their initial investigation." Let's hope the exoneration of people like Johnny and Capier proves how life-altering that can be. Thank you for tuning into my podcast episode. I'm just a true crime fan like you are, and I really appreciate you taking a chance on me. Please subscribe and tell a friend if you like spending this time together. You can also find me on YouTube in the flesh by searching Katie Does Crime.